Chapter 3, Counter Economics, Our Means. Having detailed our past and status present, and glimpsed a credible view of a far better society, achievable with present understanding and technology, no change in human nature needed, we come to the critical part of the manifesto. How do we get from here to there? The answer breaks into two pieces naturally, or perhaps unnaturally. Without a state, the differentiation into micro, the manipulation of an individual by himself in his environment, including the market, and the macro, the manipulation of collectives, would be, at best, an interesting statistical exercise with some small reference to marketing agencies. Even so, a person with a highly sophisticated decency may wish to understand the social consequences of his or her acts, even if they harm no other. With a state tainting every act and befouling our minds with unearned guilt, it becomes extremely important to understand the social consequences of our acts. For example, if we fail to pay a tax and get away with it, who is hurt? Us? The state? Innocents? Libertarian analysis shows us that the state is responsible for any damages to innocents it alleges the selfish tax evader has incurred, and the services the state provides us are illusory. But even so, there must be more than lonely resistance cleverly concealed or dropping out. If a political party or revolutionary army is inappropriate and self-defeating for libertarian goals, what collective action works? The answer is agorism. It is possible, practical, and even profitable to entrepreneur large collections of humanity from statist society to the agora. This is, in the deepest sense, true revolutionary activity, and will be covered in the next chapter. But to understand this macro answer, we must first outline the micro answer. The function of the pseudoscience of establishment economics, even more than making predictions like the imperial Roman augurers for the ruling class, is to mystify and confuse the ruled class as to where their wealth is going and how it is taken. An explanation of how people keep their wealth and property from the state is then counter-establishment economics, or just counter-economics for short. The actual practice of human actions that evade, avoid, and defy the state is counter-economic activity. But in the same sloppy way, economics refers to both the science and what it studies. Counter-economics will undoubtedly be used. Since this writing is counter-economic theory itself, what will be referred to as counter-economics is the practice. Mapping and describing all or even a significantly useful part of counter-economics will require at least a full volume itself. Just enough will be sketched here to provide understanding for the rest of the manifesto. Going from an agorist society to a statist one should be uphill work, equivalent to a path of high negative entropy in physics. After all, once one is living in and understanding a well-run, free society, why would one wish to return to systematic coercion, plunder, and anxiety? Spreading ignorance and irrationality among the knowledgeable and rational is difficult. Mystifying that which is already clearly understood is nearly impossible. The agorist society should be fairly stable relative to decadence, though highly open to improvement. Let us run backwards in time, like running a film backwards, from the agorist society to the present statist society. What would we expect to see? Pockets of statism, mostly contiguous in territory since the state requires regional monopolies, would first appear. The remaining victims are becoming more and more aware of the wonderful free world around them and evaporating from these pockets. Large syndicates of market protection agencies are containing the state by defending those who have signed up for protection insurance. Most importantly, those outside the statist pockets or sub-societies are enjoying an agorist society, save for a higher cost of insurance premiums and some care as to where they travel. the agorists could coexist with statists at this point, maintaining an isolationist, quote-unquote, foreign policy, since the cost of invasion of statist subsocieties and liberation would be higher than immediate returns, unless the state launches an all-out last aggression. But there is no real reason to imagine the remaining victims will choose to remain oppressed when the libertarian alternative is so visible and accessible. The state's areas are like a supersaturated solution, ready to participate, precipitate anarchy. Run backward another step, and we find the situation reversed. We find larger sectors of society under statism, and smaller ones living as agorically as possible. However, there is one visible difference. The agorists need not be territorially contiguous. They can live anywhere, though they will tend to associate with their fellow agorists not only for social reinforcement, but for ease and profitability of trade. It's always safer and more profitable to deal with more trustworthy customers and suppliers. The tendency is for greater association among more agorist individuals and for dissociation with more statist elements. This tendency is not only theoretically strong, it already exists in embryonic practice today. Some easily defendable territories, perhaps in space or islands in the ocean or under the ocean or big city ghettos, may be almost entirely agorist, where the state is impotent to crush them. But most agorists will live within statist-claimed areas. There will be a spectrum of the degree of agorism in most individuals, as there is today, with a few benefiting from the state being highly statist, a few fully conscious of the agorist alternative and competent as living free to the hilt, and the rest in the middle with varying degrees of confusion. Finally, we step back to where only a handful understand agorism, the vast majority perceiving illusory gains from the existence of the state, or unable to perceive an alternative, and the statists themselves, the government apparatus, and the class defined by receiving a new gain from the state's intervention in the market. This is a description of our present society. We are home. Before we reverse course and describe the path from statism to agorism, let us look around at our present society with our newly acquired agorist perception. Much as a traveler who returns home and sees things in a new light from what he or she has learned from foreign lands and ways of life, we may gain new insights on our present circumstances. Besides a few enlightened new libertarians tolerated in the more liberal statist areas on the globe, toleration existing to the degree of libertarian contamination of statism, we now perceive something else. Large numbers of people who are acting in an agorist manner with little understanding of any theory, but who are induced by material gain to evade, avoid, or defy the state. Surely they have hopeful potential. In the Soviet Union, a bastion of arch statism and a nearly totally collapsed official economy, a giant black market provides Russians, Armenians, Ukrainians, and others with everything from food to television repair to official papers and favors from the ruling class. As the Guardian Weekly reports, Burma is almost a total black market, with the government reduced to an army, police, and a few strutting politicians. In varying degrees, this is true of nearly all the second and third worlds. But what of the so-called first world? In the social democrat countries, the black market is smaller because the white market of legally accepted market transactions is larger, but the former is still quite prominent. Italy, for example, has a, quote, problem of a large part of its civil services, which works officially from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m., working unofficially at various jobs the rest of the day earning black money. The Netherlands has a large black market in housing because of the high regulation of this industry. Denmark has a tax evasion movement so large that those in it, seduced to politics, have formed the second largest party. And these are only the grossest examples that the press has been able or willing to cover. Currency controls are evaded rampantly. In France, for example, everyone is assumed to have a large stash of gold, and trips to Switzerland for more than tourism and skiing are commonplace. To really appreciate the extent of this counter-economic activity, one must view the relatively free capitalist, quote-unquote, economies. Let us look at the black and gray markets in North America and remember this is the case of lowest activity in the world today. According to the American Internal Revenue Service, at least 20 million people belong in the underground economy of tax evaders, using cash to avoid detections of transactions or barter exchange. Millions keep money in gold or in foreign accounts to avoid the hidden taxation of inflation. Millions of illegal aliens are employed, according to the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Millions more deal or consume marijuana and other proscribed drugs, including laetrile and forbidden medical material. And there are all the practitioners of victimless crimes. Besides drug use, there are prostitution, pornography, bootlegging, false identification papers, gambling, and prescribed sexual conduct between consenting adults. Regardless of reform movements to gain political acceptance of these acts, the populace has chosen to act now, and by doing so, are creating a counter-economy. But it doesn't stop here. Since the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit enacted federally in the U.S., most Americans have become counter-economic drivers. The trucking industry has developed CB communications to evade state enforcement of regulations. For independents who can make four runs at 75 miles an hour rather than three runs at 55 miles an hour, counter-economic driving is a question of survival. The ancient custom of smuggling thrives today from boatloads of marijuana and foreign appliances with high tariffs and truckloads of people from less developed countries to the tourists stashing a little extra in their luggage and not reporting it to customs agents. Nearly everyone engages in some sort of misrepresentation or misdirection on their tax forms, off-the-books payments for services, unreported trade with relatives, and illegal sexual positions with their mates. To some extent, then, everybody is a counter-economist. And this is predictable from libertarian theory. Nearly every aspect of human action has statist legislation prohibiting, regulating, or controlling it. These laws are so numerous that the, quote, Libertarian Party, which prevented any new legislation and briskly repealed 10 or 20 laws a session, would not have significantly repealed the state, let alone the mechanism itself, for a millennium. Obviously, the state is unable to obtain enforcement of its edicts. Yet, the state continues. And if everyone is somewhat counter-economic, why hasn't the counter-economy overwhelmed the economy? Outside of North America, we can add the effect of imperialism. The Soviet Union has received support from the more developed countries in the 1930s, and large quantities of instruments of violence during World War II. Even today, trade heavily subsidized by non-repayable loans props up the Soviet and new Chinese regimes. This capital, or anti-capital, being that it is destructive of value, this capital flow, together with military aid from both blocs, maintains regimes in the rest of the globe. But that does not explain the North American case. What exists everywhere on Earth allowing the state to continue is the sanction of the victim. Every victim of statism has internalized the state to some degree. The Internal Revenue Service's annual proclamation that the income tax depends on, quote, voluntary compliance, unquote, is ironically true. Should the taxpayers completely cut off the blood supply, the vampire state would helplessly perish, its unpaid police and army deserting almost immediately, defanging the monster. If everyone abandoned, quote, legal tender, unquote, in favor of gold and goods and contracts and other exchanges, it is doubtful that even taxation could sustain the modern state. This is where the state's control of education and the information media, either directly or through ruling class ownership, becomes crucial. In earlier days, the established priesthood served the function of sanctifying the king and aristocracy, mystifying the relations of oppression, and inducing guilt in evaders and resistors. The disestablishment of religion has put this burden on the new resistors. The disestablishment of religion has put this burden on the new intellectual class, what the Russians called the intelligentsia. Some intellectuals, holding truth as their highest value, as did earlier dissenting theologians and clerics, do work at clarifying rather than mystifying, but they are dismissed or reviled and kept away from state and foundation-controlled income. Thus is the phenomenon of dissidence and revisionism created, and thus is the attitude of anti-intellectualism generated among the populace, who suspect or incompletely understand the function of the court intellectual. Note well how anarchist intellectuals are attacked and repressed under every state, and those arguing for an overthrow of the present ruling class, even only to replace it with another, are suppressed. Those who propose changes which eliminate some beneficiaries of the state and add others are often lauded by the benefiting elements of the higher circles and attacked by the potential losers. A common characteristic of most hardened black marketeers is their guilt. They wish to make their bundle and then return to the, quote, straight society. Bootleggers and hookers all long someday for reacceptance in society, even when they form a supportive sub-society of outcasts. Yet there have been exceptions to this phenomenon of longing for acceptance: the religious dissenting communities of the 1700s, the political utopian communities of the 1800s, and, most recently, the counterculture of the hippies and the New Left. What they had was a conviction that their subsociety was superior to the rest of society. The fearful reaction to themselves they generated in the rest of society was the fear that they were correct. All of these examples of self-sustaining sub-societies failed for one overriding reason: ignorance of economics. No social binding, no matter how beautiful, can overcome the basic glue of society, which is the division of labor. The anti-market commune defies the only enforceable law, the law of nature. The basic organizational structure of society, above the family, is not the commune, or the tribe, or the extended tribe, or the state, but the agora. No matter how many wish communism to work and devote themselves to it, it will fail. They can hold back agorism indefinitely by great effort, but when they let go, the flow, or invisible hand, or the tides of history, or the profit incentive, or doing what comes naturally, or spontaneity, will carry society inexorably closer to the pure agora. Why is there such resistance to eventual happiness? Psychologists have been dealing with that since they began their embryonic science. But we can at least give two broad answers when it comes to socioeconomic questions: internalization of anti-principles, those seeming like principles but actually contrary to natural law, and the opposition of vested interests. Now we can see clearly what is needed to create a libertarian society. On the one hand, we need the education of the libertarian activists and the consciousness raising of counter-economists to libertarian understanding and mutual supportiveness. We are right, we are better, we are surviving in a moral consistent way, and we are building a better society, they say, of benefit to ourselves and others, our counter-economic and counter-groups might infer. Note well that libertarian activists who are not themselves full practicing counter-economists are unlikely to be convincing. Libertarian political candidates undercut everything they say of value by doing what they are doing. Some candidates have even held jobs in tax bureaus and defense departments. On the other hand, we must defend ourselves against the vested interests, or at the very least lower their oppression as much as possible. If we eschew reformist activity as counterproductive, how will we achieve that? One way is to bring more and more people into the counter-economy and lower the plunder available to the state. But evasion isn't enough. How do we protect ourselves and even counterattack? Slowly but steadily, we will move to the free society, turning more counter-economists on to libertarianism and more libertarians on to counter-economics, finally integrating theory and practice. the counter-economy will grow and spread to the next step we saw in our trip backward, with an ever-larger agorist sub-society embedded in the statist society. Some agorists may even condense into discernible districts and ghettos, and predominate in islands or space colonies. At this point, the question of protection and defense will become important. Using our agorist model from Chapter 2, we can see how the protection industry must evolve. Firstly, why do people engage in counter-economics with no protection? The payoff for the risk they take is greater than their expected loss. This statement is true, of course, for all economic activity, but for counter-economics it requires special emphasis. The fundamental principle of counter-economics is to trade risk for profit. The higher the expected profit, the greater the risk taken. Note that if risk is lowered, a lot more would be attempted and accomplished, surely an indicator that a free society is wealthier than an unfree one. Risk may be lowered by increasing care, precautions, security, and by trusting fewer persons of higher trustworthiness. The last indicates a high preference for dealing with fellow agorists and a strong economic incentive binding an agorist subsociety and an incentive to recruit or support recruitment. Counter-economic entrepreneurs have an incentive to provide better security devices, places of concealment, instructions to help evasion, and screen potential customers and suppliers for other counter-economic entrepreneurs. And thus is the counter-economic protection industry born. As it grows, it may begin insuring against bursts, lowering counter-economic risks further and accelerating counter-economic growth. Then, it may provide lookouts and guarded areas of safekeeping with alarm systems and highly technological concealment mechanisms. Guards may be provided against real criminals, besides the state. Already, many residential, business, and even minority districts have private patrols, having given up on the state's alleged protection of property. Along the way, the risk of contract violation between counter-economic traders will be lowered by arbitration. Then, the protection agencies will start providing contract enforcement between agorists, although the greatest enforcer in the early stages will still be the state, to which each can turn the other into. Yet that act would quickly result in one's expulsion from agorist sub-society, so an internal enforcement mechanism will be valued. In the final stages, counter-economic transactions with statists will be enforceable by the protection agencies, and the agorists protected against the criminality of the state. At this point, we have reached the final step before the achievement of a libertarian society. Society is divided between large agorist areas, inviolate, and statist sectors. And we stand on the brink of revolution.